Hello and welcome to a podcast about elements in the periodic table. This podcast will be about rhenium. Its symbol is Re. It's in the periodic table. If you've got some time, pull it up on your screen and have a look at it and see if you can find it. It's in the sixth row in the middle with the transition metals. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I have a bit of a chat about things scientific to sort of exercise your mind and get you thinking a little bit, and slowly, podcast by podcast, I hope to make you into scientists, all of you, everyone out there. It would be great if the world was full of scientists, so I'd definitely have a few more friends. Now, I might be a bit out of breath because I've got to actually do some walking while I'm actually podcasting to you. Now, why I decided to do rhenium, symbol Re, is that the last podcast I did was about molybdenum disulfide, or molybdenum, and I sort of rather like molybdenum because it's got a bit of a sort of a surprising story. It's one of these elements that we sort of around the place, but we've sort of walked into it and sort of discovered it by accident. Sort of the way that I discovered sort of, I have to stop saying sort of, discover ingredients while I'm cooking. I sort of accidentally find it and accidentally add it. It's a great new flavour. So molybdenum disulfide had an accidental application where people found it solved a problem which people were banking on making money out of solving. And then, of course, people have used molybdenum disulfide as a lubricant because of its sliding nature. But in molybdenum disulfide, you have roughly one in every 500 atoms there being this rhenium. Now, rhenium is actually quite a rare element. And rare element, if you're thinking, it's got a use and it's rare, you can guess it. It's got a scarcity and a demand, so it's quite an expensive element. So it's actually rarer than gold and rarer than platinum, which is sort of in between the two in terms of rarity. So I think it's probably got a price equal to or in excess of platinum. So what is the use of rhenium? So elements like gold and mercury are precious metal and the metals, and they're in the platinum group. They're sort of meltable and workable. They're malleable, and that's great for making jewellery. I've got someone walking up here. I'll say hey, hello to him as he goes past. G'day, mate. Okay, he looked at me rather strangely. Okay, so you've got the platinum group, which is off to the right of those transition metals. I'll lock you into the where it is in the periodic table after I've told you its use. And to the left of the transition metals, you have the refractory metals. So these are the metals which you use for their strength and also their ability to endure high temperatures. So they're pretty bad for jewellery because that's sort of, you want your jewellery to actually be formed and crafted into beautiful things. Hopefully I'll walk away from the traffic there. So these are refractory metals, and we actually need them. And the thing that we really need them for is the making of jet engines. Now, jet engines are a fantastic social invention in that it's allowed the population of the world to move, or the wealthy world at least, to move from continent to continent. It's allowed the actual ideas and cultures to flow, information and people to flow quickly around the world. It's actually shrunk the size of the world. So the invention of the jet engine is a very important technology. It's also obviously brought with it risks. So, besides terrorism, it's brought the risk of disease. So, you can spread disease very quickly with a jet engine. So, it's very important. And so you could really pick any refractory metal and build it into your jet engine, because as the fuel ignites and the oxygen mixes and the temperature increases, the fuel expands and then pushes out the jet engine. And so it's actually not the expansion of the gas, it's the expansion of the gas through a nozzle, which causes the other fan blades in the jet engine to throughput the oxygen, throughput the air. So there's a sort of bypass ratio in jet engines. So it's while it does that, you actually need a refractory metal, that is something which is retains its strength and can take high temperature. It doesn't actually glow and evaporate. And you can actually see things like metal iron evaporate. You just take a piece of cutlery or a paper clip, and if you've got a gas stove, you stick it into the flame and you'll see the flame change colour as the actual metal oxidizes and metal ions evaporate into the heat. This is at even quite low temperature. Nothing would happen with the refractory metal. And you have, I suppose, your refractory metal in your older style lights. And so they can attain great temperatures and it still stay solid. Your old tungsten is a refractory metal. So rhenium is really important for engines, and it's the thing that really made the engines work. It's not giving them the ability to take a high temperature. It really sort of crystallized and locked down the dimensional stability of your jet engine under the great forces. Now, what happens is that, although you can't see it, if you put a great force on a metal, it actually draws out and changes dimensions over time. A bit like squeezing into a tube of toothpaste, but obviously very, very small. Now, these very small changes are very, very important, because a jet engine is a precision built thing with bearings and very close tolerances. Now, you could say, oh, look, I could build it with room, a bit of ease. So if you've ever built a bike, you wind off the bearings a little bit and let it rattle around a bit, but of course at very high speeds this wouldn't work, and you have the problem that over time, if the actual shape just ever bends ever so slightly, your thing which spins at incredibly high speed will go out of whack. And I suppose this is a very small effect, but in terms of the lifetime of your jet engine between surfaces, you can essentially just leave your part in there and just inspect for cracks, which is a catastrophic failure. So rhenium, being one of the, I think, the second last normal or non-radioactive element to be discovered, a non-made element, was discovered in 1908, is sort of a very important element, even though a few people have heard of it. It's not very abundant, but it's an important element because it's allowed great social change to occur. Sort of just sitting in the periodic table, these elements which you think, oh, it's not very important, is actually critical to our civilization. And now, at this point in time, although I've taken you a tour, I think Millennium's all one up and one to the right. In the fifth period, in the middle of the transition elements, the rhenium's in the sixth period. Now, there are seven periods in the periodic table, starting with one, hydrogen, two, lithium, three, lithium, sodium, and then potassium, and going all the way down to francium. Now, francium is in the seventh period. This is looking at the alkaline metals in the first group. Now, these metals, francium is radioactive, So it's actually the naturally occurring elements really begin to peter out in the sixth period, and we've had a splattering of elements which are beyond that, are radioactive after bismuth. Well, bismuth is right on the borderline. It's just ever so slightly radioactive, but after bismuth, things become radioactive, and that means they decay. So you only get the really odd things like uranium, which has got a very long lifetime, and it happens to have a long lifetime because it's got a magical number of neutrons and protons which make it relatively stable compared to its neighbours. So uranium is a bit odd. Uranium's in the seventh period, and then you get those very funny periods of those funny elements, and we've really stopped looking after we've filled out the end of the seventh period. I think this is sort of almost a nominal way. We could really, in my opinion, keep on searching till we found elements in the eighth period that have a very fantastically short lifetime. So there's sort of almost a cultural drive to find exactly the right number of elements in the seventh period so the periodic table is complete. It is visually and culturally complete. It's almost a religious document, the periodic table. So rhenium is in the sixth period, and we've got this idea that periods tell you the number of shells. So if it's in the sixth period, there are six shells, and each shell is the sixth shell has got electrons in it with the sixth principal quantum number, and the principal quantum number is 1 plus the radial plus the azimuthal. So the principal quantum number, which is that 1 or 2 or 3 or in this case up to 6 in front of the in front of the orbital, which is the description of that electron. Now, it obviously starts to be very hard for people to imagine, why do you call electrons having different orbitals if you draw these concentric circles and confine them to this circle? And it's basically where the device, the teaching device of putting electrons in a circle, though it's very easy, it's a very convenient way to actually put electrons in, because you can count them and tell them people where their principal quantum number is. The fact that you call them orbitals starts to lose its meaning, and also the idea of the principal quantum number telling you the energy of an orbital also loses its meaning. Although the position looks as though it will have a certain energy filling, and you have this intuitive belief that electrons in a higher period will have a higher energy, and not a lower energy than each subsequent period. That sort of intuitive view is intuitive from having a fairly, I suppose, low quality two-dimensional model of how electrons fill up. Now, rhenium is in the D block, or transitional elements, transition metals, having a quantum, it does have six shells, and there are some electrons in it with a principal quantum number of six, and principal quantum number is 1 plus the radial plus the azimuthal. So that's 1 plus radial plus azimuthal, and how it gets to 6 is 1 plus 5 radial. That's, if you imagine, I suppose, an avocado, it's got the skin and the seed, and that surface of the seed is that surface inside the electron. When I say inside the electron, we'll have a bit of a discussion of that a bit more, that inside the electron, yes, the electron is a big surfaceless light fluffy thing, and the nucleus is really small inside it. And we might stop there for a second. How do you actually get something which is lighter, less mass, having more volume? Well, it actually goes to the fact that the Schrodinger wave equation is a wave equation. It's an equation of waves. It's actually saying that the electron is a graph, a wave, if you like. If you saw an electron drawn, you'd say that's a graph. So it's actually a three-dimensional. The reality of an electron is that it is really a graph. And the Schrodinger wave equation says, on the left-hand side, if I do this to the graph, which is looking at how its curviness is, and that equals, sort of very simple, accessible English, it says the curviness of the graph, if I do a graph of its curviness, how curvy it is, that's curving up and down, that equals that graph times the energy deficit, or that graph, how much that graph is weighted by the energy at each individual point. That's a simple, I suppose. F equals ma is sort of fairly similar to it, but it is an equation of equations. Now, the important thing is that basically you have a mass term in it, and if it's got a smaller mass in space, it's less curvy. And being less curvy in space means it's bigger. It takes up a physical volume. So let's get back into the Schrodinger wave equation. I'll see if I can try and explain it. If you have a, I'm just trying to think, coming into my mind, you have a dancer with a wand and one of those ribbons which moves up and down. Now, if the dancer does big, beautiful movements in space, they can possibly get the ribbon to bounce up and down once or twice, then winding it down, back again. Now, this is a sort of a bad mixture because the electron itself doesn't move around in space. It actually exists in space, pulsating in space. It's actually rather beautiful to watch. But this example, I have my dancer with a stick with a ribbon on it. They move it slowly, and slow curvature of it being nice and light takes up a large volume. However, the music changes and they want to be really angry. They can make the ribbon go back and forth in a really small space with high curvature in it. I'm sure there's actually a lot in it. And so, but getting back into it, if you vibrate space, you'll have these nodal lines. This is points where the ribbon appears to be stationary, or the drum appears to be stationary. So if you do something like a metal plate or a drum and you put rice on it and you hit it, where the drum is moving up and down quickly, the rice will move and it'll start to migrate to these things called nodal lines. This is where left and right, or front and back of this line, the drum is moving up and down, and you can imagine it swaying. This is the seesaw tipping point, the fulcrum of movement, of wave movement. So with so too with electrons, the actual fully electron is described by how many nodal lines there are in it, or nodes. So if you want your radial node, which is quite efficient at the end of the day of getting electrons as close as possible to the nucleus, because it always exists in the nucleus. It doesn't have a node, a zero existence at the nucleus. So there's a lot of electron at the nucleus. So your radial electrons, or radial nodes, which is pure radial nodes, which are the S-shells ones, which are pure radial ones, are actually lower energy. And that's why your S-shell starts off at the lowest energy. And then your D-shell, that's actually two azimuthal cuts across it, and they're actually quite high energy, and basically they come in much, because they're high energy, they come in much later and actually infill, or although you might say it's infill, it's actually the actual S shells are Q-jumping. So they Q-jump getting into the atom. So if you want to actually look at this, go to the dynamicperiodtable.com, a beautiful website, where you can see the periodic table in full interactive glory. So I'll say that one again, that URL again, dynamicperiodictable.com, and go on it and find RE, press on it, and you'll see the card. And it's a beautiful idea that after Mendeleev wrote the elements on cards to convert his card game into a table form, although his table form was rotated in a different way, so his groups were periods when he first drew it up. But it's beautiful deference to the original idea that we've just kept his card and kept on writing more and more information on it. So on the information on it, you'll have the electron configuration. I'll have to think it quickly in my head. The first shell, or principal quantum number equals 1, has 2. Then the next one can have 8. That's 4 times 2. 9 times 2 is 16. 16 times 2 is 32. 25 times 2, and so on. So 25 times... So it's fairly quiet and glue book at night, but you do essentially have the odd car going past. Getting back to it, your fifth period is 25 times 2. It's got 50 potential electrons in it. And this rhenium has got 6. This is the sixth period. It's got some electrons with a quantum, principal quantum number of 6, which is the Q jumpers, those S electrons. So you'll see the last number will be 2 there, or 2 or 1, I think it will be 2. Perhaps even 3, oh no, pretty much 2. But then the shell beneath will have some number slightly short, and as you go across, more and more elements, more and more electrons will jump into there. So you actually have the F shell filling in all the way in there, because you've got lutetium, which is the first of the transition metals and the last of the lanthanide series. But we'll go back again. There's a lot to understand, and perhaps there's some understanding you'll take away with this. One is the ability to go into the periodic table, look at one element, and see how the next element is related to it in terms of history. So we've gone in on molybdenum and actually moved down one and one to the right to rhenium, and come out again. Looking at rhenium, above it is technetium, which is actually a really rare element. It's actually radioactive, and it's a gap in the periodic table. It's completely man-made, even though it's right in the midst of stable elements either side of it. But the idea of being able to go in there and then to start to think on these fairly complex ideas, and if I can say so myself, it is complex simply because we've wanted to make historically at every stage a simple explanation. Sort of like the parents trying to explain things by making up more and more ideas, and eventually the explanation, which is bolted onto each other, becomes quite complex. It's sort of like walking into a bazaar There's lots of blind alleyways, and you sort of remember your way to one point, and then to the next point, and then to the next point, so you've worked out your long way of things which are quite easy to remember. There's a lot of fairly simple things which are easy to remember, and you can work your way out again using this recording method, but it's sort of hard to know where you are geographically. So the principal quantum number is sort of like your way into the bazaar, which gives you guidance in your periodic table and a lot of historical ways to interact with people and ideas on the periodic table. But your geographic, your GPS, is to actually know all these different electrons and know how the electrons are built of different quantum numbers. They're actually four quantum numbers that I'll quickly go over this. There's the radial quantum number, which is how the electron itself, this big fuzzy ball, is vibrating radially, that is like waves going away from an explosion out from the center. There's the azimuthal one. There's the magnetic one, which actually tells you how that azimuthal cut is arranged. So you can choose how to cut, and the different permutations of cuts. Sorry, it's making an awful lot of sound here. That's an air brake happening. Azimuthal series of cuts gives you all those options. But by the time you get here, it's a very similar energy. And the final one is the spin quantum. Isn't that making heaps of noise? It's supposed to be a... Sorry. So let's start it again. There's the radial, azimuthal, magnetic, and spin. Now, spin... I'll have to do another one on this. Spin is really, really fantastic. Its actual origin is the conversion of, I suppose, quantum mechanics into special relativity. You have your space-time, time, x, y, z, and that converts to, surprisingly, matter, antimatter, spin up, spin down. A bit crazy, but what's really interesting about it is... there's something called the rotational or group symmetry. And the group symmetry of an electron, in fact, indeed all particles, and if you've found it hard to believe that smaller things are bigger, and there are such things, such a world in which surfaces don't exist, you'll find this hardest to believe. The electron has S2 symmetry, which chemically says it's got spin up or spin down. But S2 symmetry has got a sort of real-world view. The actual something with S2 symmetry that you could hold in your hand is a Möbius strip. You can actually convert the symmetry of your Möbius strip by cutting it and rotating one of the ends on through 180 degrees. I flip over and re-gluing it. But actually means physically for an electron, it's got a rotational symmetry of not 360 degrees, which we all have. You know yourself, if you turn around 360 degrees, you have a rotational symmetry of that. An electron has a rotational symmetry of 720 degrees. This may be hard for you to believe. It's really, obviously, it's impossible for someone in the 360 degree world to imagine why electrons are like this. I've gone on a roll here. This is why quantum mechanics is so fantastic. And you say, well, this is really hard to imagine. I have to rotate a cup not once but twice to get back to its original symmetry. And so this means that electrons can either occupy either of these two symmetries. And it's sort of fundamental aspects of the universe. And this rotational symmetry is why the symmetry is broken. There is an absolute rotational symmetry. There is, throughout the universe, an absolute zero state of rotation. If I rotate, there's no relativity of rotation. It's quite interesting, but it's actually built back into the equation. And so this actually, spin up, spin down, is why there can be two electrons in every orbital, one spin up, one spin down. You can't have two electrons in the orbit of both spin up, because that would, there's a symmetry violation, but if you just do the calculations, it gives you infinite energy to try and the two electrons repel each other. Or you could think of it another way, as the electron fabric not being able to take, you can't actually play two notes, get two separate notes out of a guitar string. I'll try and say that possibly a little bit better. Where this is actually impossible to imagine, but in your face, the periodic table is doubled. Okay, there's two electrons in the S block, your hydrogen, lithium, beryllium. So beryllium is that second spin electron. So the entire periodic table is so someone's made it, and they've actually doubled it. That's why there's that symmetry in the periodic table. So although all this beauty and interest in electrons are hard to see, it's there very much in your face, and very much in terms of understanding how spin is so difficult to solve. And it's very beautiful to see experiments which show spin. Now, you might be aghast at this point in time. All I can say is go to the internet, type in S2 symmetry. It's a beautiful symmetry, and start to have a look around, and you'll see this is the pathway to greater understanding. And it may be true, by not discussing it, people feel more secure and they understand more in the short term by not being overwhelmed, by not discussing it. But I don't know, look, we are adults in this world of science, and at some point in time we have to speak to you. So there's more surprises as you come along. Well, not really surprises. What can I say? There's more universally held misconceptions that society is grabbing onto. So I hope this has helped, and I hope it's stimulated you to look on the internet, look under S2 symmetry, look at the electron orbitals, pictures of orbitals, and try and understand that what you have been taught at school, these shells and principal quantum numbers, are taught with the best intentions. It's just that people have, over time, taken an intention, and it's somehow become a dogma which stops people moving onwards. People are very much told things, and instead of stopping and saying, oh, hang on, is that interesting? That's an interesting way to go or move forward. People have decided, look, I don't want to listen to that person. It's too hard. I don't want to move on. But be assured, it is worth looking some of these things up, looking up principal quantum number, looking up S2 symmetry, look up the radius of an electron, why don't you? And you'll look at the classical radius of the electron, which is the smallest size an electron could be. With classical, non-quantum mechanics, and even in that, its size is bigger than a nucleus, bigger than a proton. Okay, that's spoken to you to a full 34 minutes. And I'm coming back from my cardiac walk. It's actually beautiful. I'm feeling really good now. And I'm going to say, in the meantime, keep on doing science.